In the name of God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Amen. Well, thank you, Vaughan, for inviting me. It is my first time in Warwick, and this is a stunning church. I've been down to see the crypt, the Beetians down in the chapel, and it's absolutely wonderful. So it's a real honour to be with you in this Lent series of Lent lectures. So thank you for the invitation. I'm afraid I'm using you a little bit as guinea pigs. This is a chapter in a book that is coming out shortly called For God's Sake, Reimagining Priesthood and Prayer in the Church of England. So that's just a little plug as well. So not only am I using you as guinea pigs, but I'm also asking you to have a look at that book when it comes out. My second child, now a young man of 25, is currently training as a teacher and has recently landed a job at Twyford Church of England High School in Ealing in London. He is at the beginning of what will be, hopefully, a long and fulfilling career, teaching young people not only enough to pass their exams, hopefully, but also what it means to be a mature adult, to have the emotional, intellectual, spiritual, and physical resources to cope in an increasingly complex world, able to form long-term and trusting relationships, able to be good parents, employable and with a fulfilling work-life balance, able to look beyond their own needs and give of themselves that others may benefit, to love their neighbour as themselves. My son will have, over the next 40 years, God willing, a key role, directly and indirectly, as a formative influence on the lives of many young people as they grow towards adult personhood. So what lies ahead for him? Education in Britain today is complex, with political and ideological tensions at play, with much invested in children as the future, as was ever the case since the concept of childhood emerged. The formative processes of early years and school are fundamental to the development of the adult person. In 2010, Frank Field MP produced a report, The Foundation Years, commissioned by David Cameron. He is also engaged in the latest cross-party work led by Andrea Leadsom MP that has produced work entitled The 1001 Critical Days. They're the first 1001 days of a child's life. Field recognised that poverty is not merely a material, but is also an emotional, social, psychological, and cultural phenomenon. Children who are emotionally impoverished, who are poorly attached to their parent, struggle to learn in school, to socialise. They are difficult to educate and often end up in the criminal justice system or with chronic health problems or both. Field pinpointed two prime times for intervention: the early years of life, from the womb until 5 years, to enable children to be able to benefit from school. And of course, the initiative Sure Start was exactly introduced, must be 15 years ago now, to address that time of life. And then at secondary school, so pupils learn to be good parents, socially, emotionally, culturally literate, so that they can form trusting relationships as adults. Frank Field spoke of the rupturing of a good parenting tradition over recent decades, and that it should be a priority to reverse this social trend for the good of society. He was surprised to hear from teenagers that they agreed. Some time ago, he writes, I asked to meet a group of 15-year-old pupils in one of Birkenhead's most challenged schools. Birkenhead is his constituency. I asked each of them to list for me which 6 outcomes they most wanted to gain for themselves from attending school. Their replies both shocked and delighted me. Without exception, all those young citizens listed the wish to be taught how to be good parents. Field talked afterwards with the head teacher and learned that the majority of that group had rarely, if ever, known parents who put the needs of their children before their own. So what should be the distinctive contribution that church schools can make in Britain today? Church schools have their ideological detractors, but are widely recognised as offering a high standard of education to children and young people that is valued by parents, whether churchgoers or not. I will suggest here that in a time of change, the Church of England should take the opportunity to become more distinctive in what church schools offer, drawing on the resources of Christianity, mining long traditions of reflection on how human personhood is developed and shaped. Behind my thinking is the assumption that education is a formative process that enables habits of heart, mind, soul, and strength to be established, that in turn enable the person to love God and others as themselves, so that it becomes second nature to be self-giving, to put the needs of others above one's own, with a commitment to make a better world. That the great commandment that we heard in our reading, the great commandment of Jesus Christ, to love God with heart, mind, soul, and strength, and one's neighbour as oneself, should frame that distinctive education. It's important to be clear, and to make this clear to those who make a common misconception. Church schools are not faith schools. Faith schools serve a particular faith group, whether Muslim, Jewish, or Pentecostal, and will typically have an admissions policy that draws children predominantly from that particular faith group. A church school, on the other hand, will have admissions policies that try to reflect both church allegiance and a commitment to the children within its catchment community, regardless of their religious or denominational background. I know it becomes complex in practice, but in my experience, church schools will reflect their surrounding community. Some are mainly, as I lived in Bradford, or even totally educating Asian heritage children, for example. And to give a little history, the Church of England's engagement in education dates back to 1811, when the National Society was founded, and the Church of England first promoted the education of the poor in the principles of the established church. By the time of the 1944 Education Act, a large proportion of the nation's schools were church-owned and run. This act reformed the education system after the Second World War, primarily to provide secondary education for all children. During the 1980s and 90s, there was a plethora of education acts and continuing debate about the role of religion in education, which continues at the present time. In an increasingly secular age, the question of the extent to which education should be religious and what that means is never far away and has become of particular interest as other faiths have claimed the right to have state-sponsored faith schools. And the landscape, as we all know, is changing fundamentally in today's education world as we see a revolution that takes us towards academies and free schools. My sense is that the Church of England needs to be right in the thick of all that, proactive, aware of its strengths, and able to promote its distinctive contribution. So what does make Church of England schools distinctive? The culture or ethos of the school is important. The head teacher and governors, usually, hopefully with local clergy, will seek to embed particular values so that the children of different faith backgrounds or none feel at home. Sometimes the Christian teaching and virtues will not be explicit for fear of causing offence, but rather the Christian roots of the school will be evident in a commitment to the needs of the whole child, with recognition of the spiritual alongside the emotional, intellectual, and physical needs. The local clergy and lay people usually will play a key role in leading assemblies, offering teaching and classroom assistance, and as school governors. Against such a backdrop, in a time of change, what might make the Church of England nationally contribute to the education of children at primary and secondary levels? How might that education, as a formative process of deep significance in a person's life, shape the adult? What is distinctive about what Christianity brings to this formative process that enables what it means to be a human person? Well, this begs an important question about the nature of the human person, a question that requires greater clarity as different conceptions of personhood will emerge in a secular and plural society such as ours. Such working ideologies tend to be invisible, taken for granted, and quickly stir defence. So I'm going to stick my head above the parapet and say that I tend to recognise three aspects to our dominant contemporary secular anthropology, understanding of the human being. Excessive individualism, a tribal understanding of identity, and an instrumental or utilitarian mindset. So three things there, and I'm going to go through them now one at a time. The Joseph Rowntree Foundation has described excessive individualism as the greatest contemporary evil. In education terms, this can mean that a child will be placed at the centre of his or her education as an individualised, sort of atomised self, following her own pathway through, seeking self-actualisation as the goal. And secondly, the category of identity is often the dominant way of speaking of oneself. Identity, whether defined on cultural or religious or gender or sexuality lines, is the first descriptor that a person will use. Such identity labels can foster a tribal sense of belonging rather than a commitment to humanity as a whole. Tribal belonging often leads to cycles of violence and revenge caused by a tribal defence of honour and reputation. Thirdly, it can be hard not to be caught up into an instrumental or utilitarian mindset, and that is when we start to value things and relationships only in terms of how useful or purposeful they are to us. So I want to say, in contrast, Christianity offers a very different understanding of what it means to be human. St. Paul's first letter to the Corinthians, for example, where he described the body of Christ as made up of many members who contribute distinctly to the whole, and most importantly, who care for the least reputable. Paul's sense of the corporate offers a challenge today to a society that is increasingly atomized, instrumental, tribal, challenging us to be self-giving rather than self-promoting, which means we counter a me, me, me way of being and the social atomism that can result from selfishness. That we love our neighbours as ourselves, taking us into public service and more personally into the responsibilities of love. That we resist cycles of violence and revenge. Christianity teaches forgiveness, an increasingly forgotten and admittedly difficult virtue today. The world desperately needs people who know how to forgive. And thirdly, Christianity teaches us about doing and being for its own sake, rather than for utilitarian or instrumental purposes and ends. The worship of God is a prime example, an activity that has no obvious usefulness, utility, or instrumental advantage. So Western society, I would argue, tends to be individualistic, tribal, and instrumental. And we need to ask ourselves as a society whether there are other better ways of being human. I suggest here that Christianity offers wisdom to the question of what enhances human personhood. How do we rebuild a society where we can transcend individualized identity into a sense of belonging that is not tribal, but which can hold together and pass on a strong sense of virtue in this diverse nation that Britain has become. And if you remember, in the letters of Paul, particularly to the Galatians, he talks about in Christ, we transcend tribal identity, Jew and Greek, male and female, into something bigger and better. And I suggest that that is the wisdom that we need to be looking for here. An instrumental approach often applies to education itself. It is seen as a means to an end, a good career, self-fulfillment, getting on in life. To understand education not instrumentally, but as an end in itself, as worth doing for its own sake, is very difficult in today's politicized environment. But it is important, I would suggest, to hold on to this principle, because education is an end in itself, for its own sake. In a church school, perhaps one could go further and say, education is for God's sake. It is to create human persons in particular ways. And if it is for God's sake, then church schools can offer education that shapes the child, and therefore the adult, drawing on Christian traditions of anthropological thought. As the child grows and develops through school, the rich resources of Christianity in its narratives, in its worship, in the wisdom gained through centuries of thought and reflection on the Judeo-Christian scriptures, can more explicitly be used to encourage maturity of heart, mind, soul, and strength, and the love of neighbour as oneself. To be individual instead of individualistic, not to belong to a tribe, to bolster a fragile sense of identity, which happens so often as gang cultures develop, but to have character, to do things and to treat people as ends, not as means to one's own ends. So to take the great commandment as foundational is to consider the growth of the child towards mature personhood, emotionally, intellectually, spiritually, and physically. It is also to take Jesus Christ's mandate to love your neighbour as yourself into clear Christian terrain, away from the usual moral injunction of the Golden Rule, where all that is expected of one is that one should treat others as one would wish to be treated. By contrast, to love one's neighbour asks for a commitment beyond that into service of other people. It means a life of continued challenge to self-centeredness or self-promotion or self-interest, so that going the extra mile when required in a self-sacrificial way becomes second nature. It's crucial, of course, that someone embarked on such a life really does love themselves too. Good self-esteem and good self-worth are vital if one is to love one's neighbour. Otherwise, what is really happening is one's own needs for love dominate in subtle and not so subtle ways, to the detriment of self and to the others for whom we try to care. With that great commandment to help us think about the child as he or she grows to mature human personhood, let us take one of each of those areas in turn. With a husband who is a paediatrician, often our pillow talk takes off in strange directions. He is professionally interested in attachment theory, how one helps parents bring up securely attached pet babies and young children. Love matters. If a child receives the right attention from the earliest days, then the architecture of the brain develops normally, and the child grows into an adult who can form trusting relationships with emotional maturity. When it goes wrong, as so often it does, the child is difficult to educate and may end up, as I've said, in the criminal justice system with chronic health problems. The latest research in attachment theory by Patricia Crittenden, building on John Bowlby's foundations and Mary Ainsworth's work, brings it together with family systems theory to provide a comprehensive understanding of how poor attachment has transgenerational repercussions. So a child who grows up and then has children themselves doesn't know how to bring that child up, how to form real attachment. And that's what Frank Field was talking about in terms of the rupturing of a good parental tradition. And breaking such cycles is really hard and costly if tackled through therapeutic care for individuals within families. So many schools face increasing issues that result from poor attachment. What can church schools do to minimise the difficulties so that a child is able to be educated, to learn, to socialise, to develop towards an adult maturity, which means he or she does not replicate the damage when their own children are born? So there's an increasing and interesting body of literature that is emerging from the United States and Canada, which may help church schools, both primary and secondary, to equip children and young people to develop the emotional self-awareness and skills required for adult life, to give those Birkenhead teenagers what they were looking for. Paul Tough's book, What Makes Children Succeed, stresses the importance of self-control and the nurturing of resilient character. David Brooks, The Social Animal, also commends the importance of developing habits of the heart that enable the child to delay immediate self-gratification. Brooks argues that people with self-control and self-discipline develop habits and strategies that enable them to perceive the world in productive and far-seeing ways. Character, he says, emerges gradually out of the mysterious interplay and power of small repetitive action to rewire the fundamental mechanisms of the brain. Small habits and proper etiquette reinforce certain positive ways of seeing the world, he writes. So habits of the heart, nurturing a sense of character, enables the formation of the child into adulthood in beneficial ways for the individual and for the society to which he or she belongs. So with Crittenden's work, both books are invaluable resources that suggest how education might be more formative of a person's emotional character. Self-control is, of course, one of the 9 fruits of the Spirit in the letter to the Galatians. Perhaps church schools could do more to nurture virtues of character that create a second nature that offers emotional and moral knowledge to resource the challenges of adult life. Habits of the heart, then, and habits of the mind. How do we learn to learn, to think clearly and carefully? Dorothy L. Sayers wrote an essay in the 1940s called The Lost Tools of Learning, which takes us back to a different era, but which may offer wisdom into today's complex education world. She looks back to the classical education of the Middle Ages and to the practice of training the mind with necessary tools of learning. She does so, however, with awareness of child developmental theory, as it began with Jean Piaget in the 30s. She argues that a child has 3 clear stages in which they learn. The first, from the very beginning, is an absorbent time, when the child will learn all sorts of things quickly and easily, able to memorize, keen to distinguish different categories of things, often enjoying words for the sound of them, without understanding fully what they mean. Sayers believes that this is the time for the child to learn as much as possible, knowledge that will offer a bedrock to later stages. The second stage is when the critical faculties start to come into play. The child will enjoy arguing, playing, catching others out. And the third stage is when knowledge gained in the first stage and the second, and the ability to question and argue, come to fruition in the ability to make a good case, to persuade in a cogent, careful way. So Sayers believes that these basic tools of learning are the essential acquisition of a good education, which corresponds to the classic trivium of the past of grammar, dialectic, and rhetoric. And it's a good essay, well written and persuasive, although she was very aware in the 1940s that her views would be controversial in educational circles. She was keen, for example, that very small children learnt Latin, as an awareness of grammar structure from early age enables an ability with language that becomes more difficult to acquire the older one gets. And interestingly, in my local town of Bury St Edmunds, the primary schools are beginning to reintroduce Latin. It is making a comeback. And perhaps this might lead to a greater appreciation of how small children of primary school age enjoy learning things off by heart. Sayers emphasises how much fun it can be, giving the child the sense of a satisfying achievement when presented in a positive way. Parents and carers can help very small preschool children to make the connections in their minds that help. Nursery rhymes, simple poetry, multiplication tables, prayers can all be made a game that help the child to learn, enable the child to gain the first tools of learning. So one of the places where Sayer's understanding of education is as providing the tools of learning can still be seen in practice is in the training that any Anglican chorister receives in cathedrals and here also, here in this church. From the age of about 7, a child is gradually introduced to highly sophisticated music, often in foreign or ancient language, and again we've heard French today, and learns such material off by heart to perform to an extremely high standard. By the time the child has grown through puberty, they have a cultural repertoire that they never forget and that inspires a majority to continue to sing and perform. And because they've learned to perform, many go on in public life. It will be interesting to see how much of this pedagogy that is alive and kicking in the Anglican choral tradition may be transferable through to church schools. So the tools of learning experienced in song schools are developed in other areas of primary and secondary school education. How good it would be if local churches decided to direct resources into promoting music and singing in choirs much more than they do, as a fruitful way of countering that excessive individualism and utilitarian trends that shape so many of today's children. So the great commandment differentiates heart, mind, soul, and strength as it also holds them together. What does it mean to have a soul? Perhaps something along these lines, a sense of awe and wonder at that which is mysterious, including language, and words that are not immediately understood. A conscience that enables the person to tell right from wrong, to feel shame when offence has been caused, to be moved to say sorry. An aesthetic sensibility that prompts the person to respond to beauty or to find in nature and the universe a freshness deep down things. To have a soul is to begin to understand the height, length, depth, and breadth of love as experienced in relationship with other people and with God as the ultimate ground of loving being. How might church schools enable the child to grow in this dimension as someone who knows how to nurture their spiritual life? Again, enabling certain habits to develop may help. One's soul grows through a lifelong exploration of love and thankfulness for the gift of life. When one sees one's personhood in these terms, one has a very different understanding of what it means to be human. Life based on a sense of gift. It becomes much less easy to think in terms of rights, for example. One does, of course, have rights, as our society conceives them, and it's really important that such rights have their place to ensure justice and opportunity are there for everyone. But to base one's understanding of self on gift rather than right means, though, that one will tend to give thanks for what one has rather than forever seek what one does not have. The habit of giving thanks is a beginning. And closely allied to that sense of gift is forgiveness. In a world where cycles of revenge and violence can easily become the norm, and I think are on the increase, particularly when the honour of an individual or tribal group is offended, to learn the importance of forgiveness becomes a particular gift that Christianity can offer. To learn to forgive takes time and practice, best begun from one's earliest years, habits of the soul that form the child into someone who is able to love, to give and forgive. And then finally, we love God with all our strength. Robert McFarlane, in his book The Old Ways, A Journey on Foot, writes this. The relationship between thinking and walking is also grained deep into language history, illuminated by perhaps the most wonderful etymology I know. The trail begins with our verb to learn, meaning to acquire knowledge. Moving backwards in language time, we reach the Old English, Leonian, to get knowledge to be cultivated. From Leonian, the path leads further back into the fricative thickets of Proto-Germanic and to the words, and I can't pronounce it, which has a base sense of to follow or to find a track, from the Proto-Indo-European prefix lice, meaning track. To learn, therefore, means at root, to follow a track. To learn is to follow a track. It encourages the person to walk. There is increasing research that indicates that walking is good for us. It enables a person to be strong and healthy, fit and active. It has become beloved of writers. Many need to walk in order to think, as Macfarlane is here suggesting. Walking can enable psychological health as well. Soren Kierkegaard, the Danish theologian, wrote this: "Above all, do not lose your desire to walk. Every day I walk myself into a state of well-being and walk away every illness. I have walked myself into my best thoughts, and I know of no thought so burdensome that one cannot walk away from it. If one just keeps on walking, everything will be all right." Many are concerned about how much time children spend in front of the screen today, and how in one short generation the time spent playing outside has gone. There is a growing literature on the toxicity of childhood, commending instead time spent out of doors. The Forest Schools movement actively seeks a re-engagement of children with the natural world, not only for their own fitness and well-being, but also because a sense of good stewardship of the natural environment is an increasingly urgent imperative. When children know and understand the natural world around them, they begin to honour and care for it in ways that are not possible in ignorance. With an underlying understanding that the world around is an evolving, created order, revealing the creative love of God, rich in its diversity, church schools could do and are doing much to strengthen the child's sense of awe and stewardship of the natural world. Physical well-being and strength of body also results from such engagement with the world outside the classroom. So some ideas that might enhance the Christian ethos and culture of church schools by focusing on the heart, mind, soul, and strength of the child. Education is viewed here not as a means to the end of the self-fulfillment of a good career, or the self-realization of the individual, or the self-expression of a particular identity. The goal of education is that a person may grow as a human being who is able to love because she or he has emotional, intellectual, spiritual, and physical well-being and health. To love with heart, mind, soul, and strength gives the child and then the adult a formation, a foundation in life that begins with the formative processes of education. This is to foster a sense of the human person marked by self-giving, forgiveness, love of others, commitment to public service, and to the natural environment. Such persons are likely also to have a good sense of self-worth and self-esteem. Self-worth begins, I would say, as the growing person looks outward from the self, not self-absorbed as so many youngsters can be, learning habits of heart, mind, soul, and strength that take him or her away from self-centeredness and the desire for immediate self-gratification, towards the ability to be self-giving, putting the needs of others before one's own. The great commandment asks of the human person that she or he loves God with heart, mind, soul, and strength, and the neighbour as self. To know what it is to base one's life on love and forgiveness, thankfulness, the gift of life, and to express that love with self-giving resilience of character, this is to begin to realise a mature human personhood. Such qualities would have enabled Frank Field's teenagers in Birkenhead to find what they were seeking of their school education, the resources to be good parents. Church of England schools, I would like to commend, are well placed to make a greater distinctive contribution to that end. Thank you for listening.